So welcome. Welcome to all of you. This is a time which, as I've been contemplating this course and preparing it and meditating on it, I've come once again to something that I find very powerful about these teleclasses. They are really alchemical. And those of you who've been on these calls, who've taken these teleseries, have probably experienced that. Some of you who are new to them may not. So as we, in the next 3 weeks, take this deep dive into ourselves, one thing I'd like to remind you of in the beginning and that we'll keep coming back to as the weeks go on is that the real essence of what we're doing here is not simply the information that will be imparted, though I promise you there will be information imparted. It's not simply about the practices, though there certainly will be a lot of practices. It's really about the opportunity that we get in this situation to take the kind of deep dive into ourselves that we can only do with support. So as we look into our inner poisons and discover the nectar inside them, as we begin to recognize the light that is often concealed within what we may initially experience as darkness, as we dive into aspects of ourself that we may have known were there but not embraced, as we see the extraordinary gifts that we contain that we often can't realize without being willing to be open to ourselves, to be vulnerable to ourselves, to embrace ourselves, all of ourselves. And this is possible, this process is possible because of the energy of the group, because of the energy of my lineage, because of the energies of all the lineages that are coming together in all of you, because of our willingness to practice, and because of our calling to self-recognition. So, once again, welcome. And before we go into the class, into the, let's say, the meat, or as my guru used to say, he was a vegetarian, so he would say the vegetable of the class. Let me start by explaining the format. First of all, I'd like to say there are a lot of people taking this course. There are over 130 people. Some of you are on the call live. Many of you are downloading the classes on MP3, either because you're busy during this time or because you're out of the range of easy calling in. So I also want you to know that the energy vortex of this Turning Poison into Nectar class is very much present, whether you're here live, whether you're listening to it tomorrow or the next day on the download, or whether you listen to it a month or 3 months or a year from now. So on these calls, I will be mostly lecturing, leading contemplations and meditations. At certain times, we'll also open the lines to questions and comments. In addition, later on tonight and tomorrow, you'll receive a homework assignment, which includes instructions for meditation and also the exercises and inquiries that you'll be able to work with over the course of the week that will let you really process what I believe you've come to process. And also, if you want to work with a partner, there will be exercises, practices, inquiries that are very, very fruitful to do with another person. So if you don't have a natural partner, if you're not, for example, taking this class with a friend or a so to speak, real-world partner, a daily life partner, you can also work with a partner by sending a note to Deb Buxton, my assistant, who will get you together with someone you can work with by phone or even in person if you're in the same part of the country, the same part of the world. I would say that the partner work can really enhance the whole experience of the class, and it's really nice to have someone to discuss things with. But a lot of the community experience will happen on the listserv. And the listserv is a very vibrant part of this of these courses. On the listserv, you're encouraged to ask questions, share your contemplations, your experiences. Some of you will be very active on the listserv. Some of you prefer to lurk, which is also fine. I'll also answer the questions that come in on the listserv. So just know that pretty much any question can and will be answered, and except that if the question feels too personal or too private for the listserv, you can also email me and at sally@sallykempson.com, and I'll answer them, your questions, privately by personal email. So just a line, a word or two about the in-between call practices. It's certainly possible to do this class by simply listening to the classes or the downloads. But the most powerful way to take this class is to do the exercises. If you do the exercises every week, even when you're busy, it will let the energy inside the exercises kind of work inside you, open up inside you. I often say that these practices are like those Japanese flowers that come in little, you know, those little bunched up pieces of paper that when you put them in water, they expand and they become a flower. So, and that's what the practices that we're doing here really are. I'll be sending you a core contemplation to do every week, which you can do in half an hour or 45 minutes. So I would really like to encourage you to set aside some time during the week to do the contemplation. Some of the contemplations will seem so rich that you'll actually want to do them more often. And I also should tell you that sometimes I just can't contain myself. So I send several practices. And sometimes so many practices that you'll feel, oh my God, I don't think I can do these all. But I just want to tell you that I will let you know which practices are more or less at your own discretion and which practices I'm recommending that you do, no matter what, barring very difficult circumstances. So those will come to you, some of them by email and some of them as audio files that you'll be able to download from the private area of the listserv. And I would also say that if you need to contact Deb, either to set up a partner relationship with another member of the class or to get some technical assistance, her email is on the emails that you've received preparing you for the class. And the most efficient way to contact her is personally, deb@sallykempton.com, rather than sending the note to the listserv. Okay, so that's the housekeeping. And we'll get back to that at certain times, at certain moments. We're going to begin by invoking the energy of presence, the energy of grace, the energy of our deep self by chanting a set of mantras that really invoke the deepest guiding presence that we all hold within us. These mantras are traditional. They come from the lineage of one of the great yogic lineages of India. They've been being chanted for a couple of thousand years. I learned them from my teacher, Swami Muktananda. And the reason that I like to chant them in these classes is because they very powerfully invoke that aspect of inner presence, the aspect of the deep self, of our Buddha nature, that we call the guru, the guide. Carl Jung, whom I'm going to be quoting quite a bit during these weeks, because he is the man on shadow, Carl Jung used to say that our God image, our image of the divine, is actually a projection of the light of our inner being, of our Buddha nature, of the wisdom and love, the awareness bliss that is innate in us, that we project it outside onto a deity figure, and then we worship that deity figure. So what this mantra and what the tradition behind this mantra does is relocate our projected divinity within ourselves. The mantra literally calls forth the power of the inner guiding consciousness that so many of us keep in shadow. So as you chant, feel that you're calling on your own living power of light, the underlying awareness that is your deep self. And if the mantras in the tune are familiar to you, that's great. And I'd like to ask you to really see if this, in this chanting session, in this session of chanting, you can really experience them as new. Not, for example, as mantras that you've chanted in your yoga classes, mantras that you associate with a part of your life that's, you know, perhaps no longer a part of your life, but really as mantras that speak to the deep self. And a moment of translation, you should have them on the sheets, the chanting sheets that Deb sent you. And if you don't have them, then you can listen. The mantras mean, I bow to, I honor, I surrender myself to the deep self, to the inner self, under the name of Shiva, which means that which underlies that pure beingness that underlies the mind, that underlies the world, that underlies consciousness itself. The nature of this being, which is ourself, is invoked as Sat Chit Ananda, which is perhaps the most evocative definition of inner presence in the Eastern traditions. Sat, pure being. Chit, pure intelligence, pure consciousness. And Ananda, pure contentment, pure bliss, pure love. So we're actually invoking that in us, which is pure being, pure awareness, pure love, and whose nature is to guide, to teach, to hold space for our alchemical transformation, who is peaceful, formless, that which is without the need for any form of support, and which is never not supporting us. And we'll chant with Krishna Das, whose voice has a beautiful, heartfelt quality that that many of us love. And then we'll do some mantras for offering our practice and continue.
Nishprapanchaya Shantaya Nirvana.
We offer our practice, asking that through the power of our practice, all beings may have happiness and the causes of happiness. We ask, may all beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. May they know the sacred joy that lies beyond suffering. May we have equanimity beyond grasping, hatred, and ignorance. And may we experience the equality of all that lives. So, having offered our practice for the benefit of all beings, we ask for the grace of our true self, our essence, our Buddha nature, the divine energy that unfolds constantly within all of us. We ask that the enlightening force of the universe surround us, infuse us, that the laser of truth interpenetrate any confusion. We ask the pure fire of awareness and love hold the space for us to see, to know, to accept, and then to let go of whatever may obstruct our journey. So in this moment, you can find yourself a posture that's comfortable and upright. If you're sitting on a chair, make sure that both feet are flat on the floor. If you're sitting on the floor, it's really good to have something supporting your butt so that your buttocks, your hips and thighs are at least 2 to 3 inches above your knees. Inhaling, feel the contact between the base of your posture and your seat. Exhaling, allow your body to rise upward through the crown. Inhaling, feel that the chest lifts and opens. Exhaling, allow the shoulders to circle around so that your shoulder blades clasp the back. Let yourself sway a little bit from one buttock to the other until you come to the place where your weight is naturally held equally on both buttocks. The chin is just the tiniest bit tucked. The crown is rising towards the ceiling. And your awareness now comes to the breath. Feel the breath pouring in the way the tides in the ocean, the waves in the ocean pour up to the shore and then flow back. And as you allow the breath to flow in and out through your nostrils, perhaps you feel it flowing down your throat and into your upper chest. Perhaps you feel it lower in your body. But as you breathe in, as you allow the breath to flow in, feel that it flows in, filled with light, particles of light. And if you're not a visualizer, simply feel that these particles of light are flowing as pure energy. Pure, let's say, purifying energy. The energy that comes to us from the very center of being. The energy of creative consciousness itself manifesting through the prana, the life force. So inhaling the particles of light from the atmosphere, allow them to flow into your being, and then with the exhalation, feel that whatever is confused, whatever is difficult, whatever is tense, whatever is tight, whatever is sorrowful, whatever is irritated, whatever is restless, all these qualities flow out with the exhalation like smoke rising from your heart and flowing out with the breath. So inhaling, you draw in particles of light, particles of pure energy. Exhaling, you breathe out whatever feels obstructive or tense, not with a feeling of aversion, but really with the feeling of allowing everything that might be obstructing or holding you to simply pass out on the breath. And if thoughts are arising, if you're getting distracted, breathe those out also. But first, notice them. Recognize their thoughts. And let them flow out with the exhalation as the inhalation gently and delicately draws in particles of light energy. The exhalation softly and delicately allows thoughts, emotional knots, tensions in the body, everything that seems to hold you, tie you up in this moment, let it just flow out with the exhalation. We're going to return to this practice several times in the course of our time together. And what I want to say is that essentially there are two classical yogic methods of working with shadow energies. Almost every other practice falls into one of these categories. The first is the method of what we could call purification, where you breathe in one form or another, the purifying force of breath, and you breathe out whatever needs to be purified. And this practice of breathing in light and breathing out obstructive energies in the form of smoke is a very, very basic way of just helping ourselves clear. And the other method, which we'll be doing later in the class, is one of the processes that arises when we really begin to look at shadow such that we recognize the transformative energies locked up in what seems to us to be unacceptable. A few days ago, as at my last talk at the Colorado Yoga Journal Conference, I was giving a class on working with emotions, and about 3 minutes before the end of the class, a man raised his hand and said something like this. He said, I feel that when I look into myself, all I see is fear, craving, and anger, and I don't see how I'll ever get past it. So I tried to work a little bit with him in the time we had left. And in the course of it, I was really seized with a recognition of how complex it is for us to look into our own egoic patterns, our own shadow, and how important it is that as we do it with a real sense of compassion for ourselves. In the Eastern tradition I was trained in, and in many spiritual traditions, we are taught, maybe not purposely, but somehow it comes across, we're taught to fear and dislike our own egoic patterning, especially the manifestations of it that are gnarly, you know, like what the man was talking about, fear, craving, and anger. We often see them as kind of monsters that lurk in the background and keep us from really swimming in the light water that we know is our essence. And because we fear them, we push them aside, or we fight them, or we try to keep ourselves in situations where we don't have to feel them. And then what happens is that they pop out, often in embarrassing ways, like the pimple that erupts on your chin the day before prom. And they kind of surprise us. So I want to just start with a story that expresses this, that I think is actually one of the great stories about shadow. It's a story of the yogi who spends 3 years in retreat in a cave, a real hardcore retreat, meditating and performing austerities. He meditates for 12 hours a day. He does simple chores. He feels enormous peace. And at the end of the 3 years, it's time for him to come down out of the cave, off the mountain, and he packs his few belongings. He hikes down the mountain to a nearby town, and there, this is in India, where this kind of thing is normal. He sets up a blanket on a street corner, puts out his begging bowl, and because it's a place where people respect holy men, several passers-by put money in the bowl, and then and they pay him respects, and some of them even sit down to see if he'll impart some wisdom. And then after a couple of hours, this fat-looking merchant comes swaggering by, and he sees the yogi sitting on the pavement with a begging bowl in front of him and disciples sitting around, and he says, "You so-called holy men, you're too lazy to work, so you beg from honest citizens. You should be ashamed. I'm not going to give you any money." And the yogi at that moment feels righteous rage rising in his heart. You know how the ego is. The best way to get the ego to pop out is to accuse us of something that we didn't do. The yogi says, "You idiot, what do you know? I've been in retreat for 3 years. I'm steeped in yoga. You should be honored to throw a few pennies to me." And at that moment, the merchant says, "Ha, is that all you got from your so-called yoga? You can't even control your temper?" Now, I think this is one of the great gotcha moments in yogic literature, and there are versions of it in every tradition. And it's also a perfect example, of course, of how it's really hard to hide your unprocessed shadow. I don't think there's anyone, certainly not me, who hasn't experienced such an unexpected and humiliating display of some part of yourself that you don't even like to look at, much less reveal in public. You really thought you had it together, and then something triggers your anger or your injured pride, and your snarkiest, most uncooked self comes roaring out of its hole, and you're forced to realize that you're just not as awake or self-realized as you thought. I actually get a lot of the letters that I get from people who've read my Yoga Journal column are about this issue. You know, I'm peaceful on the mat. I'm happy when I'm hiking in the mountains. I can be loving with the people in my book group, but then, you know how it is, your roommate says something insensitive, your mother nags, your partner leaves the dishes in the sink for the umpteenth time, and you just blow it. My favorite line about this is an old friend of mine who said, back in the early days of her practice, "I can see God in everyone except my husband, Bernie." And I think she was really speaking for every yogi, meditator, Buddhist, centering prayer practitioner, and seeker of truth who has ever confronted his or her own blind spot. So all of us, you know, at some point, we just notice that we're hitting the wall in certain areas. There are parts of our body that are numb. Certain situations make us angry. We keep choosing partners who don't love us. You know, our teachers let us down, as teachers seem to inevitably do. You know, we start to recognize that thread of anxiety or that layer of sadness or that fear of doing the wrong thing or being abandoned or the negative stories that just keep playing over and over again. And sometimes, you know, it happens, the wake-up call comes from outside. You know, our friends, our partners, our teachers, or often our students keep busting us for the same stuff over and over again. You know, or we just shoot ourselves in the foot one too many times or get sick. And at that point, we realize that, okay, it's time to come to terms with those parts of the personality that you've been hiding from, not looking at, ignoring, or just refusing to recognize. And often they're qualities that you've been embarrassed about all your life, selfishness or irritability. But some of them are strengths, light-filled, empowered qualities that you just haven't been willing to see. You know, some of us have the ego of putting ourselves forward and acting out. Some of us have the ego of hiding, but what we're hiding may be positive as well as negative, something that's crying out to be expressed. In fact, the tantric traditions tell us that we all literally have deities inside, gods and goddesses inside, archetypal energies that want to be expressed through our personalities, and yet which also need to be, as it were, tamed and contained within our human selves. And much of the work of learning to express the divine inside ourselves is also the work of learning to calibrate the ways in which our great qualities have been distorted or hidden. Because it's not only our secret darkness that we hide, it's also, as Marianne Williamson famously said, our light, our greatness. And the deal is that both our darkness and our buried light lurk in that part of ourselves that Carl Jung famously called the shadow. The shadow. The yoga traditions have fantastic practices for working with shadow. And I want to say something about some of these practices that we're not going to work with, because it's very important that we understand them, that we understand their significance. For example, the practices of what we could call cultivating virtue, which is very much a part of all spiritual traditions, the yamas and niyamas of Patanjali, are actually practices for working with shadow, for getting us to see into and deal with our shadow qualities. They are, again, completely essential to any shadow work, understanding and knowing how to work with this particular set of practices. So, in the yogic tradition, shadow is sometimes called klesha, which means the causes of suffering. The Bhagavad Gita calls shadow qualities demonic, which is a little scary. But what Jung understood was something that the Tantras understood as well, which was that shadow qualities aren't necessarily bad. Shadow includes all the aspects of yourself that you've hidden. And Jung, who was a deep explorer of Eastern traditions, his work incorporated what to me is one of the core recognitions of Tantra. Tantra famously tells us that when we look inside and find the material within us that's unprocessed, primitive, difficult, that if we know how to work with it, that is, not act it out, but work with it, hold it, contain it, create an alchemical container for it, what we can discover is that in the poison is the nectar. In the poison is the nectar. And Carl Jung said, in the shadow is the gold. So these two principles that inside what we hide from ourselves is actually the source of, let's just call it our power for of transformation, the energy we need for spiritual and personal growth. It's often unavailable to us because we're using it to suppress the parts of ourselves that feel unacceptable, or because we're unconsciously acting out qualities in ourselves that that we have not allowed to come to consciousness. So they're running us from the basement. So to liberate that energy, we need to begin by recognizing, owning the separate parts of ourselves, whether the separated parts of ourselves, whether they're qualities like buried anger, or actually qualities that are very much a part of our beauty, but which are not perhaps acceptable to the society that we grew up in. You know, I personally spent my teens and 20s trying desperately to be a bad girl so that people wouldn't notice that I was actually an introverted geek. But we also hide our sexuality, our ambition, our pride, and of course our beauty. The spiritual psychologist David Riccio, who's written a great book on shadow that I'll send you the information about if you want to go further with some additional reading. David Riccio points out that shadow qualities, the dark qualities, are often the negative side of very positive ones that we haven't been able to own. So for example, coerciveness can be the shadow side of leadership that a leader needs to recognize and understand. Flakiness can be the shadow side of a capacity for flow. But before we can find the positive opposite in our hidden negativity, of course, we have to face into it and find a way to work with it. And, okay, so you can just pause and close your eyes. Allow yourself to be present with the breath. Let your awareness now flow in with the breath, flow into the heart. Perhaps with the feeling that the breath is actually flowing in through the center of your chest. My favorite practices, many of you know, with the sense that there's a softening opening in the chest wall and that the inhalation can just gently and naturally flow in through the center of the chest and caress the energy in the heart. And have the feeling that the inhalation collects whatever in your heart feels limiting, hard, sharp, painful, blocked. And that with the exhalation, it's gently, 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 gently carried out so that the next inhalation can just move inside your heart with gentle, energetic fingers and soften and open the heart. The breath comes in, flowing in as particles of light, particles of loving, subtle, tender energy, the energy of acceptance. The breath accepts us. Just let yourself breathe in that subtle feeling of nurturance and acceptance. Let it touch the heart. And then let the exhalation gently carry out without you even having to name them. Just having the intention that to let the breath carry out whatever is holding on to sorrow, whatever is blocking you, whatever is asking to be released. No aversion, no attempt to make it happen, just letting the breath flow into the heart and out through the heart. To do shadow work seriously, you need to be able to recognize that the shadow both is you and is not you. In other words, to really, really work with shadow, it's really important to also have an experience or at least access to that part of yourself that's free of shadow, whether it's the witness or the love in the heart, whatever aspect of yourself, whatever practice can allow you to really stand in what you are. Because when you aren't in touch with the inner self, the pure consciousness inside you, it's very hard to actually look into your darkness. And this is one of the reasons why so often when someone criticizes us or we lose our temper or we fail at something, we either try to deny it or hide it or sort of bullshit over it or defend ourselves. So one of the beautiful things about having done some inner practice, some yoga, is that it actually allows you to stand in yourself, to stand in your light, and then look at and own the qualities in you that are in your way while recognizing that your ultimate identity is consciousness, is essence. And yet at the same time, if you don't do that recognition, you're probably going to stay a little bit stuck. Carl Jung said something that I think is the basic principle behind shadow work and one of the reasons that we need to do it. One does not become enlightened by imagining figures of light, Jung said, but by making the darkness conscious. I would say, by the way, that imagining figures of light is actually one of the great components of enlightenment because it allows us to recognize our light self, our deep self. But, of course, he's totally right. And there are some very profound recognitions of this in different aspects of spiritual literature. My favorite verse in the Tantras is from the Spandakarikas. It's verse 22. It says that the principle of transformation is deeply rooted in powerful emotions like anger or fear, when you're terrified and running for your life, when you're at an impasse, not knowing what to do, that inside these very strong, shadowy feelings, there's the possibility of recognizing the pure energy behind them, and that energy can actually enlighten you in that moment. And in the Kabbalah, the Kabbalistic texts, the Babylonian Kabbalah, they take the verse from Proverbs, from the Old Testament, the Torah, and which says, "Better is light than dark. Greater is light than darkness. Greater is wisdom than folly." And they do a little tantric twist on it. They say, "Greater is the light that comes from darkness. Greater is the wisdom that comes from folly." So the poison is capable of transforming itself into nectar. So let's just talk about what shadow is. Shadow is the part of us that's hidden. So it's not necessarily the bad stuff. It's simply the part of us that's hidden. It's the part of us that we're not willing to see. Jung actually says, you know, we tend to think of shadow, I'm paraphrasing him, we tend to think of shadow as bad or evil. Shadow is not necessarily bad or evil. Often what's concealed in our shadow are very normal instincts, insights, and powerful capacities. So, or as Rilke says, perhaps all the dragons in our lives are princesses who are only waiting to see us act just once with beauty and courage. Perhaps everything that frightens us is in its deepest essence something helpless that wants our love. So, shadow is those parts of us that tend to make us uncomfortable with who we want to be. And that's the really important thing to recognize about it. Because who we want to be, of course, is often based on our culture, on our upbringing, and on the social circles that we move in, that we live in. So, generally speaking, the disowned parts of ourselves, the tendency to disown parts of ourselves, just comes from trying to adapt to the values of our culture. A really good example, of course, is the body image issue that you know, girls who are fed the cultural imperative to be thin and hot, if their bodies don't fit the stereotype, they often will go through a period of trying to starve themselves, like Tom Wolfe's social x-rays, as he called them, wealthy women who were starved to near perfection, but that could be many teenage girls. Or we go the opposite way and eat compulsively because we just don't feel we could ever measure up to the ideal. And when we have fully internalized that cultural body image, then we unconsciously literally demonize people who don't fit it, including if we don't fit it ourselves. Robert Bly, in his famous book called The Little Book of Shadow, has a beautiful image, which many of you may be familiar with. He says, the shadow is what goes into the bag that we drag behind us. And his basic point about it, which is simplistic but useful, is that when we were kids, certain qualities in us were displeasing to our caregivers. So maybe we were too wild, we were too energetic, we were too emotional for our family circle. Maybe our qualities were, mirrored to our parents, some shadow qualities in themselves that they couldn't deal with. But the point is that our culture would not allow us did not create a container that allowed us to own our own qualities. One of my brothers is just profoundly spiritual, saint-like, actually, and the family culture was deeply unreligious, unspiritual, and my brother just buried this quality in himself, and one result of it was that in his teens he started taking a lot of psychedelic drugs, got himself into a state of deep disassociation from himself, and it was actually because he had put his spirituality in shadow. It was really only when he began to be a practitioner that he could occupy that aspect of himself, and then all his other, extremely resourceful, skillful, practical qualities began to come out as well. So, these qualities go into the bag. Maybe our anger, our vindictiveness, our selfishness, our wildness, our expressiveness, negative qualities, but also positive qualities. And then, of course, there they are, essentially ruling us from inside. So, one of the great issues that women have is that middle-class girls are expected to be nice and not express anger. So women repress our hostility and aggression, and then we act it out by mean girl behavior. As we all know, there's nothing meaner than feminine shadow. Ostracizing other girls, catty comments, general snarkiness. And in the same way in our culture, married men are supposed to have sex only with their wives. We're supposed to be in monogamous relationships. And so men whose sexuality isn't like that secretly watch porn on their computers, and then there's hell to pay when their wives see what they're doing. And then, of course, we have the conservative congressman who opposes gay marriage and is caught in a men's room having a tryst with a male prostitute. That's an extreme example, as is the spiritual teacher who is seen to have a suppressed private life, which may not in itself be so abnormal, or maybe it is, but the consequences of that buried shadow of sexuality or lack of understanding about money, all those things, when they are discovered, they bring us down. And then there's just our normal way of being. For example, the way we can lavishly praise a friend who's successful and then secretly rejoice when something bad happens to that friend. This is this sort of secret Schadenfreude, as it's called in German. Rejoicing in other people's troubles is one of the classic expressions of shadow. There are four main ways in which shadow manifests in our lives. First, it remains unconscious while being an active force in our lives. And we were just talking about that a couple of minutes ago. Shadow is unconscious, but from the unconscious, it actively works in our lives. A classic example of how this works is someone who's passive-aggressive, who may have hidden her own assertiveness, doesn't express anger. So when she's upset with you, she doesn't tell you about it, or it could be a he. Instead, he shows up late or forgets to tell you something important or promises to pick you up and forgets. or borrows money and doesn't pay it back. Another classic example of unconscious shadow behavior that I think we see all the time is in people who want to be a leader, who want to be a star, but who for one reason or another have repressed that natural human urge, don't allow themselves to admit it to themselves, often because, you know, if we live in a in a kind of yogic counterculture, you're not really supposed to have ambition like that. So what that person does instead is kind of rebel against all the leaders and the environment. And, you know, this is the person that you always find kind of critiquing the person who's stepped out or stepped up, often, honestly, seeing that person's flaws, because, of course, there is such a thing as honest critique, for sure. But the point is that it's often motivated not by honest critique, but by unexpressed shadow issues. So the real task, and it can be hard, is to look at the true motives and values that lie behind some of our apparently, let's say, helpful, caring, yogic behaviors. For example, a mother whom I met recently, whose daughter is highly successful. She's a professor. Has big grants, and the mother said to me that she prays every night for her daughter to begin meditating because she says the girl's under so much stress and she doesn't know what could help her. And as I talked to her, I recognized something that that actually we often see in parents, a desire to help a grown child because it makes her feel needed, or sometimes it makes you feel superior. So it's very, very fruitful, and we'll spend some time doing this as a homework assignment, just to look at things in yourself that, and most of us have a sense what they are, because we're all very conscious people. You pick a lover who's withdrawn and then you feel victimized. Or in my case, I'm copping to something I've never admitted publicly before. I'm a quite straightforward sort of monkish type, but I have a hidden flirtatious diva who comes out when I'm with a friend and her boyfriend. It's something about the sort of safe container of somebody who's already taken that just makes me feel like it's safe to flirt. So, and my friends will often say to me, you know, I felt like you were just totally coming on to my boyfriend or leaving me out of the conversation. And I'll feel, oh my God, no, I was just being friendly. But it's actually the shadow diva, the shadow flirt that, probably needs some form of expression and so pops out in a situation in which it's actually inappropriate. So the first way that shadow manifests is by staying unconscious yet acting through our lives in certain respects, in certain ways, running our lives in certain situations. Again, and I'm going to ask you to look at how some of this is true a little bit later. The second way, and this is the big one, is that shadow manifests is through projection. And that being the case, one of the easiest ways to tell where your shadow is by looking at your projections, especially the projections that have charge for you, emotional charge. You know, that there's a yogic understanding about the world, which is that everything is a projection. In other words, that we only can see outside us what we have inside us. But in terms of shadow work, when positive or negative shadow qualities are suppressed, we invariably project them onto other people. So what you don't work with gets projected and mirrored back to you from outside. And this happens in several ways. Sometimes it literally shows up outside ourselves. So I know somebody who never gets angry. He's actually one of the kindest people I know. But everyone who knows him is constantly getting angry at him. It's uncanny, and I've had this experience myself of, I'll look at the guy, he'll say something, and I'll just want to scream at him. And as I started to get to know him and talk to him, of course, it became apparent that he has a huge amount of anger, unexpressed anger, that he's almost not in touch with. But so it kind of comes back to him through other people. I've also known very saintly people, especially in the world of politics and of especially nonviolent politics. When I used to be into political situations in the 70s, and yogis who are very, very saintly, are always extremely detached and sweet, but the partner, usually the wife, is practically a terrorist. You know, she's. Did you ever meet a couple in which the man was like the ideal of saintliness, someone like Gandhi, and the wife was a termagant who actually carried her husband's anger for him. But the other way that we project anger, anger, sexuality, fear, all of our shadow qualities, including our bright ones, is by literally seeing them in other people. One of the most interesting examples I've ever seen of this was during the 2008 Democratic primary. God bless those days, when Hillary was running against Obama. And I don't know how it was where you were, but in my part of California, a lot of the very accomplished women I know, women around my age, around Hillary's age, women who had literally fought their way up to positions of power in male-dominated fields like film or finance, hated Hillary. Which is hard to remember these days because now she's carrying the golden shadow for many women. But in those days, they'd say things like, she's totally ruthless, she's a liar, she enabled Bill and now then she used him to get ahead, she has a big butt, she's not a good speaker, without exception. And I started to do an informal survey. Without exception, the things that people, that these women disliked about Hillary were all qualities that they had themselves. So she actually held the shadow for people who couldn't accept feminine ambition. And again, now these days, these same women are saying how great Hillary is, what a great role model of leadership, and secretly they wish she'd won the election. It's the same Hillary, but now she's carrying the projected positive qualities of feminine strength. Just as Obama, who back in 2008 was carrying our projections of the leader who was going to save us. Now he's carrying all of our projections of failure, of, you know, the person who let us down. And, of course, neither of these are true. They're really our projections onto leaders who have qualities that hook them, that provide Velcro for them. So let's just take these moments and once again breathe light into the heart. Allow the energy of breath infused with light and subtle energy to open and caress the heart, and let the exhalation carry away all the unseen and unknown, unacknowledged, or seen and known and acknowledged qualities that stand in the way of our open self, of our vulnerable self. And you can actually, if you like, at this point, just consider qualities in yourself, qualities that you notice that you would like to dissolve. imagine restlessness floating out of smoke. Imagine a problem, a feeling of a problem floating out as smoke, floating out on the exhalation. Imagine irritability floating out. Imagine feelings of unworthiness, confusion floating out on the exhalation. Imagine feelings of betrayal floating out on the exhalation. As the inhalation brings in these subtle particles of light, so here we come to the golden shadow issue. Because, of course, just the way we project our negative qualities, we also project big time our positive qualities, what's sometimes called the golden shadow. I spent years doing this with my teacher. I just projected enlightenment, love, every single positive quality onto him. And then he mirrored them back to me, so I would feel that I was getting love and unity consciousness and experiences of enlightenment from him. Not that he didn't have a powerful effect on my psyche. He was a powerful, grace-bestowing being. But his teaching was always, first, God lives within you as you. And the greatness that you see in me is actually your own greatness. So what he was always teaching and pointing back to was, look at yourself, look at your own beauty. And we were all busily going, no, you. You know, you're the one who's light, and we're getting it from you. And if you've been in an idealistic relationship with a teacher, you probably know how that feels. There's a very, very big moment in teacher-student relationships when the student suddenly realizes that the teacher is not the embodiment of all the qualities that the student has been projecting onto him or her, and that actually the student, actually does have those qualities. And that moment can be a magnificent recognition where we actually take back our projections of perfection from the teacher and recognize what we hold in ourselves. Or it can be a moment that we experience as wildly disillusioning. And the experience of taking back our golden shadow projections can come about through disillusionment, or it can come about simply as a result of that moment when there's been enough purification and enough self-recognition that we can go, oh my God, it's in me. But however it happens, of course, we have to do it. So part of the homework assignment for this week is actually to look at strong projections and to look at how we can own them. And so in that process, I really think that we'll be able to see some of the secrets of our negative projections and what they show us about ourselves, and also the secrets of our positive projections and what they show us about ourselves. The third way that when shadow is disowned, when shadow can operate in our lives, and we've talked about this earlier, is when it's disowned, it can usurp our consciousness and possess us. In other words, we can act out of shadow while never recognizing that this is what we're doing. And of course, that's the really difficult thing about shadow, because in extreme cases, negative shadow can come out as in quite horrific ways, in physical abuse, in cruelty, in all the different ways in which human beings hurt one another, in always justifying our behavior, in, you know, without, because we're not looking at our buried shadow. In some cases, of course, shadow possession is so intense and so unconscious that we can't deal with it except by walking away from the person, or, you know, if in extreme cases, getting them out of society. At the same time, I recently met a guy who's a very, very well-known and skilled and experienced psychotherapist who spent many years working in local prisons and treatment centers with pedophile priests who had been, in some cases, defrocked and in some cases incarcerated. And he led group sessions for priests who acted out their attractions for young boys, usually. He said that, without exception, these were men, well-intentioned men, who had so buried their sexuality that it had literally possessed them. And that, you know, that they'd put it in shadow, made it unconscious, and they'd acted it out in harmful ways. And he said that that as he worked with them, not all of them, but many of them, they would go through remorse, looking at the harm they'd done, and then they would begin to recognize the need for love, the need for connection that was underneath it. And he says that there were people who he worked with, men who he worked with, who were able to deeply integrate the shadow emotions so that they no longer had to act them out. In other words, by doing shadow work with some of these people, he actually cured them, which in conventional, or rather had, you know, gave them the capacity to live normal and, you know, productive lives. And now this brings us to the fourth truth about shadow, which is what we're doing here, hopefully, to recognize that the energy of within shadow has the power to deepen and broaden our capacity for consciousness. The energy within shadow can deepen and broaden our capacity for consciousness, but only when we can recognize it, dialogue with it, and metabolize or assimilate the traits, wisdom, and behavior that are concealed in it. So we're going to start that process now. We're going to, give ourselves the opportunity to discover something that we hold in shadow. And then we're going to practice with it in one of the most powerful ways that there is to practice with shadow. So for this practice, you're going to need some paper and a pen, or you can use your computer. So you can take a moment, if you don't have something near you, to find something. And then you can find yourself a comfortable posture, a comfortable upright posture, and take a long, slow breath. Inhalation, then another exhalation. Inhaling and exhaling through the heart. Imagine yourself now walking down a path. It's a path within a garden. And you notice perhaps the path. Hi, is anyone still here?
Yes,
I am.
Oh, good. Good. The conference just bumped me off the call, so I thank you all for hanging on. And I'm so sorry it happened in the middle of meditation instructions, but we will continue. And hopefully, this I will re-record this section and you'll be able to listen to it uninterrupted on the download. So, once again, please close your eyes and find yourself in a comfortable upright posture. And let yourself take a deep breath and then let go. And again, find yourself walking down a path. It's a beautiful country garden path. It's mossy and green under your feet, or perhaps you experience it as paved or pebbled. There are trees on each side. And as you open the gate, you find yourself in the secret garden, the inner garden. So you look around and you feel the lushness of the garden. It's your garden. So notice if it's filled with flowers or if it's kind of formal and Japanese, or if it's a real deep country garden, a little bit wild, but filled with a feeling of lushness and beauty. And in front of you, you see a tree, a very old, thick tree, with a trunk that is so wide that you can lean against it, and branches that overhang and are filled with leaves. And you're drawn to the tree. It has a quality of not only beauty, but a feeling of age and wisdom and nourishment. And you see that underneath the tree is a seat, a stone seat with cushions on it. And you sit down on the seat, and you find yourself leaning against the tree. And as you inhale and exhale, you feel the support of the tree at your back. And you're able to recognize that this tree carries centuries of wisdom. It's really the tree of life. Every leaf on this tree has bounteous truth and love and wisdom. And you're supported and held by the tree. And with that support, which is also the support of your own essence, I'm going to offer you a couple of questions to ask yourself. And when you ask yourself the question, let your inner voice reply quickly. Don't think about it too much. Just ask yourself the question, let the answer come up, and then you can write it down. So take a deep breath in and let the breath go. The first question, what is my secret fear about myself? You let your inner voice answer and take a moment to write it down. second question, take a deep breath in and let it out. What am I most afraid that someone will find out about me? And again, just write down the answer that comes immediately. What am I most afraid that someone will find out about me? And write it down. Breathe, breath in, breath out. What am I most afraid of finding out about myself? Just take the first answer that comes and write it down. And finally, the last question, what is the secret beauty that I hold that hasn't yet manifested? What is the secret beauty that I hold that hasn't yet manifested? And breathe in, breathe out. And we're going to begin a process that will be continuing in the weeks to come, which is one of the great yogic processes for working with shadow, with snarky, difficult parts of ourselves. We're going to practice, first of all, with what came up for you when you asked the question, what am I most afraid to find out about myself? Or it could be the question, what's my greatest fear about myself, but whichever one seems to have charge for you. And now imagine that the you that represents the quality that you most fear, or the quality that you are afraid to know about yourself, that you'd rather not know about yourself. Imagine that the you who has this quality is sitting in front of you. And begin to breathe in this aspect of yourself that you fear, or that you're afraid of finding out. Breathe it in, breathing it in through the heart. And as you breathe it in, feel that it's being absorbed by the tree of wisdom at your back. And that as you exhale, this the great tree, the great ancient tree, is breathing back love, acceptance, light, and profound nurturing compassion back through your heart and into this aspect of you that embodies the part, the shadowy part that you're afraid about, that you fear about yourself, or that you're afraid to know about yourself. So you breathe that in through the heart. Let it be absorbed by the sacred tree. And allow the compassionate energy that's held in the ancient tree of wisdom to flow in through your heart and into those qualities that you fear that you hold in shadow. Again, you're inhaling these qualities that you fear about yourself or that you fear to know about yourself. Breathing them into the through the heart, through the back of the heart and into the tree, and allowing the life-giving, loving, compassionate energy of the great tree to flow through your heart. And irradiate this shadowed you that sits in front of you. And then you breathe in, breathing this self that you've projected outward, breathing it into your heart. Now allowing yourself, your whole body, to feel the support of the ancient world tree. To feel how as you breathe in through the heart, the flow of your breath flows out the back and into this vast supportive energy that manifests as the tree of life. And feel how the energy of the tree of life flows back into your body on the exhalation. And out into the world. Now allowing your attention to simply rest inside the heart. Bring into your heart the quality, the secret golden quality that you sense is there but hasn't fully manifested. Perhaps you have words for it, perhaps it's just a feeling, a felt sense. And as you allow the breath to flow in through the center of the chest and into the heart, imagine this golden shadow as a warm sun a subtle golden sun. That as the breath flows in, expands through your heart and through your body. And as the breath flows out, radiates from the heart, radiates out into the garden, into the tree, into your body, into your life. The breath flowing into the heart, into the golden sun, flowing out as a radiance, a subtle radiance, that is the radiance of your inner golden being. And you can sit for a moment or two. We'll say goodnight. You'll be receiving your homework via email. Have a beautiful week. Don't forget to write. And along with the download, this evening's download, you'll also be receiving a separate audio recording that actually gives this meditation in a discrete form, so you can actually just listen to the meditation and practice it. And I send you huge love. Thank you for being with us. Namaste.